So we are doing a precept ceremony June 1st. So anybody who's interested in formally becoming a Buddhist and taking the precepts can talk to me about doing that if you haven't already. You can, if you want to know more, the weekly emails have links, and there's also stuff on the website. There's three people slated to take the precepts already. Let's see. There's booklets on the back shelf that say the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. And if you want one, you're welcome to take one. We just made copies for distribution. So those are the precepts along with the reading that we tend to do around them. Let's see. And I guess we're taking a long time to study the precepts on Sundays. So if you want to do that study and you can't come on Sundays, most of those recordings are ending up available. You could also read one of the longer books about precepts if you want. And seeing as we are studying them on Sundays and Tuesdays here, I figured tonight we would jump right into the precepts themselves and maybe do three. That might be too many and not be fair to the precepts, because there's lots to discuss about them. But we'll give that a shot and see if that's too much to bite off. It won't be that much reading. So, starting on page 79, 10 Zen precepts.
The 10 Zen precepts. The Zen moral code begins with several precepts commonly referred to as the three pure precepts. These are cease from harmful action, do only good, and do good for others. These three are the essence of moral behavior, rather like admonitions in many religions to treat others as you would like others to treat you. If you were able to follow the three pure precepts perfectly, you wouldn't have any moral problem. On the other hand, human beings generally need things spelled out a little more specifically. The 10 grave precepts explained in this section are what the three pure precepts look like in practical application.
Each Zen precept can be understood at multiple levels, and in the following explanations, I will describe the function of each precept at each of these levels. At their most concrete, the precepts are instructions for your observable behaviors. At this level, not dwelling on past mistakes means not elaborating on the shortcomings of others in your speech. At a deeper level, the precepts are about your intention and your state of mind, whether or not you act out your inclinations. At this level, not stealing would mean not spending lots of time longing for what other people have. At an even deeper level, the precepts are about your state of being. How separate do you still feel from the rest of the universe? When you use the precepts in this way, not being stingy means working on letting go of self-concern to the point that it no longer becomes the first thing that comes to mind when someone needs something that you might be able to give. It is impossible to keep the precepts perfectly at these deeper levels, so there is no end to precept practice.
Not killing. At its most concrete, this precept is about not killing other human beings. Few people reading this book are going to have to fight that temptation. But the importance of this literal injunction is not to be underestimated. For one thing, while intention matters, there are more negative repercussions from killing someone deliberately than from killing someone accidentally. There is always karma from causing someone's death. This is part of the reason why war is so traumatic for soldiers. This precept also recommends minimizing the killing of non-human beings. While you have to at least kill vegetables to live, the more you can avoid killing and still maintain your health, the better. The bottom line is that killing of any kind generates negative karma, so it's best to minimize it. This is why many Buddhists are vegetarians. However, there are other things you can kill and other ways of killing. You break this precept to some extent when you reject anyone or anything, in essence, cutting it off from that which you value. You can kill someone's generosity by refusing to eat the meal they have lovingly prepared for you because they cooked meat and you are a vegetarian. If you have to kill, you try to do so mindfully, acknowledging the value of that which you are killing. If you thoughtlessly step on a spider instead of taking a moment to put it outside, it breaks the spirit of this precept more than when someone hunting for food respectfully says a prayer of gratitude over the body of an animal they have just killed.
Not stealing. Not stealing means not taking other people's stuff. However, this isn't about honoring ownership or capitalism as being part of the divine order of things. The precept of not stealing is about being respectful in your human relationships and refraining from indulging your selfish desires at the expense of others. Most of the time when people steal, they justify their actions by saying that they aren't really hurting anyone. The people they're stealing from have more than they need, or it's just money or stuff. However, if you've ever been stolen from, you realize that's not all there is to it. You rely on a culture of mutual trust, and when someone steals from you, that trust is violated. Of course, when someone steals from a corporation, they may not care at all about whether that corporation trusts them, but what is the act of stealing or cheating doing to the thief or cheater? It's building up a habit in them to bend the rules to suit themselves. You can steal in more subtle ways, of course. One of the translations of this precept is do not covet. When you obsess over what you don't have and how you can obtain it, you neglect your current life. You are always chasing after things, and what you have is never enough. This is not to say that you can't try to improve your life or have ambitions, but that you can do these things without operating from a sense of lack or insufficiency.
Potential pitfall. You might resist the precept against stealing because it seems to endorse secular material values or laws that may or may not be fair or just. However, this precept is about honoring your relationships with other people and refraining from indulging selfish desires. You're welcome to try to change the culture and laws, but in the meantime, your fellow citizens are counting on you to follow the rules. Not misusing sexual energy. The precept on not misusing sexual energy requires you to acknowledge the power of such energy and to use it thoughtfully, carefully, and respectfully. There is nothing inherently wrong with sexual energy or beauty or sensuality, but all of these things are tied up with human instincts that may run even deeper than the instinct to survive. In brief, this is potent stuff, and if you use sexual energy in selfish ways, it can be very destructive and harmful. If you have to decide for yourself what it means for you to misuse sexual energy, this precept is about taking responsibility for yourself and cultivating awareness of how you use and respond to sexuality. Most of the precepts involve being faithful in your relationships, and in the case of sex, you can use this goal as a barometer to test the appropriateness of your actions. Does your current indulgence in sex or playfulness with sexual energy honor your relationships or endanger them? If you really look at the person with whom you're engaging sexually, can you honestly say that the engagement is good for them, or are you just using them? When you dress provocatively or flirt, are you doing so with full awareness of your actions and motivations, or might you be emphasizing your sexuality because you've become dependent on it as part of your identity? No one can answer these questions for you. At the deepest level, the precept on sexual energy is about intimacy and your relationship to everyone and everything. When you have a sense of completeness and peace within yourself, intimacy follows naturally from openness and honesty and does not require seduction or pursuit.
This guy here?
Yeah. All right. Any thoughts or comments about the first three precepts?
Deceptively simple sounding.
Interesting that they're not absolutes and one may rule over the other. In the sense of a vegetarian, being a vegetarian, because you don't kill, but you can cause harm to another by refusing to eat what they've prepared. And that sense of that responsibility to do no harm kind of supersedes the harm that, to a human,
yeah,
in that case, supersedes the harm to the animal, which you didn't actually commit.
So much of it is about, with all of them, it's about intention and awareness. And you know, are you paying attention to your reactivity? Or are you, you know, like in the case of stealing, it's easy to rationalize and justify. It's like when I go visit Alan's mom in Deerfield Beach, Florida, the little old ladies will go to restaurants and they actually, like, they'll only give you enough creamers for your coffee at that time, you know, because they will take the sugars and the creamers and stuff like that, and they'll pack their purses with it.
Oh,
and
my
it's
goodness.
Just this, it's you know, and it's kind of cute, but because they've seen their friends do it and they do it, and it doesn't seem like a big deal to take it home with you.
Mm.
But you can imagine if you've got dozens of people doing this every day, that how much this is going to cost the restaurant.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of kind of thinking it through. Do I want to participate in that? You know, I know my buying one more thing that, you know, exploits workers or something like that probably isn't going to make a huge difference in the life of some teenager sewing in a, you know, sweatshop or something. But I have to make the decision, do I want to participate in that?
Yeah, there's so many different layers.
Mm-hmm.
The one on stealing, I think that also means that taking advantage of a person's generosity,
mm-hmm,
is stealing. Really, I mean, if you never pay, if you never do something in return, or you don't do it kind, or perhaps that's stealing also.
Yeah, benefiting yourself at the expense of others.
Yeah, whatever that means, expense of others.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means.
I think about stealing time.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, I should be spending time with my parrot or with my stepdad or whatever it is, and I feel like, oh, I just want to goof off and do something else. And I feel like, no, this is the time I should be spending with this other being, and by just going over here and goofing off, I'm stealing,
mm-hmm,
from our time together.
I've been thinking lately that we have to, especially on these first five precepts, you know, they were meant to be very concrete, as well as, you know, the deeper levels. So I don't want to distract from the not killing part, but I'm, in a way, I'm beginning to think of the first precept as precept of nonviolence. No violence. To me, that makes a little more sense when I think about these other things that you can kill. I mean, in terms of language, it makes more sense for me to think of just a violent reaction to it, whether it's something inside myself or something I encounter when it's like, so,
it seems to me that what prevents the precept from being just a list of just dry rules at the core. That's why the first three precepts is when you don't feel separate, then these things arise naturally. Then they're just not rules to follow in a children's book or something like that, you know. So I was wondering how deep that sense of being one, and like, I don't know, you're talking about not moving or something, like, how deep does that have to be? Like, if it's really deep, then these things come automatically, right? But can you do the converse, like, do this, and then that happens? I'm not so motivated by this, I just want that.
I think so. I mean, as long as we're doing it very mindfully and honestly, we're really practicing with the precepts and watching what it is that we feel an impulse to do and why and how does it feel when we don't follow through on that impulse, and we really study that as opposed to just adopting them as rules and beating ourselves up when we don't fill them, and if we didn't, I don't know, there's probably still some benefit to just keeping them in a rote way.
I think so.
But in order to keep them even in a rote way, you have to come up against delusion. So my prime example was with anger. And you probably heard this one before, but I just got so righteously angry about a situation, about a Dharma situation, and that, I was, and as I, instead of indulging that and expressing it and or storming off or something, I just went for a walk to cool down and kind of just postponed, it's like, okay, maybe something needs to be done, but it can't be, it doesn't have to be done this moment. And I just put it off, and like, I watched a self just disintegrate. Like, there was such a strong sense of self around that issue and what needed to happen in my version of how things looked. And in letting go of the anger, I saw how fluid reality can be. It's so that's my the first example that comes to my mind about how this actually can be a gateway to like
non-self,
no self.
Yeah. Well, Bodhidharma said the two gates of the practice and the principle. And some people enter through one gate, some people through the other. Some through, that emptiness experience of being connected to all people, that's their first shot. And for other people, it's, I'm going to adopt these precepts, I'm going to work these practices, I'm going to, and that's their gateway. And I know, when I, drop the anger, and you see how the situation changes, and there's this warm feeling of connectedness that can happen with the people that you're interacting with, or even just that stopping and putting the spider outside, and instead of crushing it, you pick it up, and maybe you'll look at it and go, oh, little guy. You know what I mean? And yeah. So it just changes that. You just get the warm fuzzies, I guess. Mm-hmm. There's something about that that adds to that sense of connectedness. Mm.
Makes sense. I mean, if you're not struggling with, actually refraining from stealing physical stuff, or these first precepts, then you have to get more subtle with them, and for me, that's the stealing part comes in with that. There's a profound sense of lack. Of basically not being completely present and satisfied with this moment, but wanting, that's that sense of lack is what will drive, far down the line could drive stealing, but it starts off with that sense of. Identifying myself with my possessions or experiences or status or pleasure or comfort or something, the things that I want to make my life feel real or worthwhile. And if you think about essentially letting go of trying to obtain anything, just completely. I mean, that'd be a pretty radical thing. I mean, it makes, if you toy with that, you realize how much of what we do is motivated by going after stuff,
like material things,
or experiences, or. I think for some people it's material stuff, but for some people it's experiences, for some people it's comfort.
That's stealing? But
well, that...
Yeah, I can see.
I mean, that sense of lack and that focus on needing to obtain... Is what would be behind, I guess for me it ended up being, I started feeling like I was stealing when I was, kind of pushing against the world to get what I wanted. Monkeying with, if I'm like, it would be really cool to, own my own house. And just kind of like letting that come if it comes, as opposed to, I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but there's something that you want a job change, or you want to happen, or you want something to happen in your life so that you'll be more comfortable or things will be more pleasurable, but it's just like you're having to start to force it, and people around you start to bristle, and things start to fight against you, seem to fight against you. Things aren't lining up. Ah.
I don't see how that's stealing. I mean, I wouldn't think of it as.
Well, it's about what it does to. It might be less about what it does to the world and more about what it does to me. If I'm grasping and reaching and pushing and kind of obsessed about it. I am indulging myself. I am indulging in a sense of lack, and I am liable to do selfish things. I'm liable to act selfishly. I'm liable to go ahead and buy something that's maybe in a crappy way, or I'm liable to drive fast to get there and cut people off in traffic, or I'm liable to just start because I'm focused in on myself and what I want, I'm liable to do harm?
Form of attachment to the outcome without regard to the cost. And the outcome may be wanting that, instilling it. And the cost, which you're disregarding, is getting caught and spending 5 years in jail. I mean, it seems free. Or it's pulling the plastic out and buying that $1,000 purse, which you can't afford, but, you know, you got credit. Credit, and suddenly you're bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And you formed an attachment and acquired.
And you end up doing harm to... You're stealing from, like, your future self who has to pay
stealing,
those bills.
Well, if you go bankrupt, you're stealing from the people you loaned you that money. If you are so intent on acquiring that it may not be material goods, but status and such, that you neglect your family, you neglect your friends, you're stealing from them, like you said, stealing time. So, you know, the...
Stealing is so... It can go so deep, like,
yeah.
You know, everybody talks about eating quinoa nowadays, right? This high protein. And then I read something about how it was the staple food for the people in the Andes who didn't really have any other source of protein. And so they couldn't afford to grow it because it was being exported. And I'm thinking, so we have all these choices, right, for protein.
Yeah.
These guys had that just one thing. But that's stealing from them, even though we pay for it, it's stealing. So I don't know where you stop. If we have a house and somebody doesn't have a house, that's stealing. In a way.
Yeah, because it's not...
Well, kind of the flip side, the other precept is about not being stingy and being generous. So exactly where one ends and the other begins is a there's no hard line, but essentially at some point, also, when you have something that somebody else could benefit from, I mean, this is how I describe it later. It's like there's no hard rule, and you have to. Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with taking care of ourselves and our those who we're responsible for, but whenever we have something, we're holding something that someone else needs. There's a karmic cost.
Yeah.
I really feel that. And I feel like that's part of our karma as Americans is kind of just like we're holding all this stuff. I think we're holding less than we used to. I think it's kind of we're kind of holding some illusions now more than anything, but still relative to many places we're holding a lot, and that hurts our hearts.
Yeah, so stealing is, in a sense, you're saying it's being greedy and taking more than we, far more than we need.
Oh, yeah.
Is that stealing?
No, I like that word taking, too. That was the word I was thinking of.
Taking,
stealing. Stealing is so connected to theft.
And ownership.
And then there's laws about it. And you can go to jail. Why would you go to jail? You go to jail for taking an object that doesn't belong to your money. But taking seems broader. Having to have, and then all the, as you're saying, the emotional energy, the cognitive energy, the spiritual energy that's caught up in the having to have. Could be very preoccupying and pull you away from your true self in this moment. And
I love it. Every time I do the precepts, I think of like better translations for them. Mm-hmm. And yet, I kind of just, you know, you stick with the traditional ones and wrestle with them each time because it's rich.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. So, essentially, I'd say, like, don't indulge in violence and don't indulge in greed. I think that's a perfect...
Yeah.
Way that, I mean, you might feel greedy inside, okay, but like don't indulge that.
Yeah.
I think we can kind of tangle ourselves up unnecessarily with wrangling with these things too. I know I have, and you know, like I had just recently had a music attorney I consulted with. He said, "Do the ask. You got to do the ask." You know, meaning if you want that gig, if you want that contract, whatever it is, you have to ask for and you have to advocate for yourself, especially if you're just working for yourself.
Yeah, makes sense.
And when you get that gig, somebody else isn't. And so, you know, sometimes I'm, you know, why are they hiring me? Why are they hiring her? You know, sometimes I get caught up in that. But there's also been times when there's that sympathetic joy that arises. It's like, you know, I didn't get that gig, but man, Rick, or that girl can sing. I'm so happy for her that she got that show. You know, and when that happens to you, you go, wow, am I really saying that? You know, so, you know, there's ways you can wrangle yourself up, and there's ways that they pop up naturally. It's like the one I really have struggled with is the sexuality, because, you know, it's the industry standard to have the hot chick on the CD cover. And, you know, here I am with my t-shirt and my blue jeans, you know, I've always been kind of covered head to toe, and then somebody commented on a video and said, we call her soccer mom blues, and I thought, something's got to change. So, you know, I wrestled with that. I said, you know what, I can doll up, and I can gussy up, I can do that, and as long as I'm tasteful and I'm not manipulative about it, you know, because there are some women out there that they're talented, but they might be marginally so, but their skirt is like up to here, and they wear Gucci shoes and the legs and all this stuff, and it's just, you know, to me, that seems to just this side of manipulation, you know? So it's like, we can beat ourselves up and wrangle, but I think as long as we do the questioning and we think about them, especially, I love the fact that we do this every year. And if you hang around any Zen temple, you're going to go through these year after year, and you're going to discuss them year after year, because they're going to mean something different to you every year. And you're going to find where you're, you know, that do not dwell on past mistakes, that means you too. You know, we'll talk about that later, but it's like, you don't beat yourself up with the precepts either.
Yeah, and the not misusing sexual energy is one, especially in our culture, is, you know, we don't have set apart past rules about what that means. You know, it might be simpler if we did, but it also was more oppressive when we did. So, it is something that we decide for ourselves. And we both know a dear Dharma sister who is in a polyamorous relationship. Husband has a girlfriend, and she has boyfriends sometimes, and it's all just, you know, and it kind of makes my head go like this, and I go, why? How does that work? But she is a Dharma practitioner, and she has studied the precepts dozens of times, and for her, it.
There's probably no deception there. I think that's the big thing.
Yeah.
What?
You know, yeah,
there's deception. I mean, if everyone knows the rules and everyone's okay with the rules and nobody's being manipulated into accepting the rules, then I guess it can work. Not for me, but...
Yeah, I think what makes me skeptical is because sexuality is so complicated. And like, okay, so that's at least four people involved. Like, how, you know, two people involved, it's hard enough to kind of understand. Are we really communicating? Do we have mutual understanding here, mutual respect? You know, it's like the more people that are involved, the trickier it gets.
And then the reactions of people to your relationship. My friends was polyamorous and... It's quite interesting, the reactions of people to her.
Yeah, well, it can, you know...
There's a lot of judgment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It can also be threatening. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, well, if that's possible, then, you know, who knows what I might have to accept or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very valuable... that's a valuable thing to explore also, because part of what gets tied up in sexuality also is a sense of ownership of people. A sense of identification and ownership of partners and how. I don't think that keeps the precept either.
So, yeah, it depends on how you feel. Do you own that person, or do you own, or jointly own that relationship? You have an interest in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And if your agreement is that it's 50-50 interest, if anyone else is getting a cut, then it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's 9 o'clock. It's kind of I don't know if next time maybe we should just like read about one precept and then stop and talk about it. Do another precept and then stop.
I think we could do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we're going on to not lying. That'll be it. Not abusing it. The first three are almost kind of, I mean, there's subtle levels to them, but they're also kind of simple in a way.
Not lying. Is that the same as speaking the truth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not lying. Not abusing intoxicants, not dwelling on past mistakes. These little titles here in the Idiot's Guide, these are called D-heads. And they can only be so long, so.
Oh.
I had to just kind of condense the precepts down. Not dwelling on past mistakes, not being attached to praise or blame, not being stingy, not indulging anger. And then I took the liberty of interpreting the Three Treasures precept for a more secular audience. So we'll just continue, and then maybe we'll stop after each one and see how much we want to discuss, and then go on to the next.
Sounds good.
Thank you all for coming.
So why is it all these knots instead of the positive language?
Well, in our precept booklet, each one has a positive, a negative and a positive. So do not kill, cultivate, and encourage all life.
Yeah.
Do not steal.
See, that's
so
what makes sense to me.
I just, like, I had to pick
one. Oh, okay.
So I just, like,
yeah.
Made the...
I thought that was
out of simplicity, I just kind of picked the not part.
Okay.
But the ancient tradition of the precept, it did start with the knots.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, that's the three pure precepts, which are cease from evil, do only good, do good for others.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of outline our vision of the process, which is usually the first thing you have to do is just stop doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Before you know what the good thing to do is. You just
have
to stop yourself from acting out the selfishness. And then you get to the positive part. So,
are we not going to read the precepts instead of the Sanzagi and stuff like that?
Well,
I like those.
Yeah, but we have a while, because the precept ceremony isn't until June 1st.
Oh, that's right.
So we could do that. I suppose we could do that April or May. I mean, we're just, like, the Tuesday thing isn't syncing up with the precepts this time.
Yeah.
We just happen to read about the precepts now because it's in the book.
Yeah. But it's nice because it's the simple thing, and then when Dogen talks about the other,
right.
It's just so nice.
Because
he's always the one to just like blow the lid off, and this is about one speck of dust, and this is about...
So it just makes it so different.
To speak not one word.
Yeah,
no.
And then all the dew on the ground, and all of that.
Yeah.
No,
we'll do it.
Yeah. It's being lazy for waiting for the sense of oneness. That means I'm trying to pop out of doing all those hard things.
I wanted to do that. I totally wanted to do that. Like, I feel miserable and separate, and I think what I want to do is just have a realization of how I'm not.
Yeah. Well, Dyer Lurie, he said it's like. I was reading and I thought, it's like a container and you feel like this one and everything pours out. So you do you won't be able to do everything, just pours out of it naturally. You don't have to force it. But then, that means it's too easy. I want the easy thing. Like, you know, it's hard not to be angry than to say, I move on with you, so I won't be angry. I don't know. But the guy that came and spoke to us, he spoke about that once. Richard or something?
Yeah.
It was very nice. He talked about Indra's net. And I asked him, I remember, like, what are you, like, talking about? I know all this, but how do you feel it? And he says, that's it.
I just corresponded with him, and he's busy the next couple months, but he'll come again in the...
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
In the summertime.
Would Sally, that lady who wrote the book, ever come?
I would like her to. But that's one of the things, like, okay, now that I'm not busy writing the book,
now
I can, like, reach out to these people and schedule.
She had a nice article in the Tricycle recently. And there was another article in Tricycle recently about what you were talking was about how you're so focused on this thing about enlightenment, you forget everything that's happening along the way, you know, all the little things, you know. So that was a very good one too.
April 1st? The Tuesday, the first Tuesday in April. I'm hoping that I don't have to be here because my family will be in town.
Oh, nice.
So I'm wondering whether the three of you can kind of hold down the fort and or talk amongst yourselves about who might want to lead the discussion. First Tuesday in April? I can email you guys about it. So you can check schedules and stuff. So that's
okay. Yeah. I'm going to be away in 3 weeks. May, June.
No, I'll be here.
That's that later.
Yes, later, but I mean, it's just...
Oh, you wouldn't be here for June?
Yeah.
You wouldn't be here for June, guys. Have...
First, yeah, I might miss it.
Yeah. And then I'll also be missing a Sunday coming up, because I'll be in San Francisco for a meeting. So, and I've asked, now Joshin can't cover for me anymore because she's so at Dharma, so she's like their head junior go-to person, and she has to be at everything. So that's a huge, that's a huge resource that's gone. So, like, there's a lady priest, she came with Diane Banage, that's the woman.
Yeah.
So she's in the area, but she's now on the SCBA board with me, so she's going to be at the meeting. Flumio's busy. And I feel bad in a way inviting people, like, I don't want this to be like their... especially like their first time here is when I'm not here.
They feel like
I don't want to just use them. I'd want to, you know. I mean, and I think you guys are perfectly capable of just, like, you know, reading something and chatting about
the
it for
Sunday,
a while.
The Sunday one. So does a beautiful job.
Yeah, she. I think she's busy that Sunday where she's like coming back from Seattle at 3 a.m.
Because of the chanting.
Yeah. So in the chanting, you can just do a recitation instead.
We've done the abbreviated one.
Yeah.
We'll do this and this and this and.
The heck is that?
I don't know. It's a tweak. It's a tweak. Okay,
huh. Well, I have a whole collection of other stuff.
So you have matches from over there.
I have eight matches.